It is 10:30. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. There is a quorum present, and we have a very full agenda today with lots of people who want to talk to us about these very important bills that are on the agenda. So I'd like us to get started. And the first order of business, of course, is approval of the minutes. Representative from last night.
We don't have them.
Oh, okay. So that makes it really fast. Okay, we can't approve them. We don't have them yet. All right. So with that, let me just say that, of course, when we have many testifiers, we're going to have to limit testimony to 2 minutes. We will have to be pretty strict about that so we can complete our business. We will be able to go until 12:30 today. But I think it will still be very challenging because we have some very important and challenging concepts before us today. So with that, we're going to call up the first bill, House File 348, Representative Howard. And on behalf of Representative Howard, who is not on the committee, I will move that House File 348 be recommended to be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. So I think that although there are a couple of amendments in the packet, I think, Representative Howard, you have elected to not offer those today. Am I correct?
Yes, Chair Liebling.
All right. Very good. Well, then we can go right to your bill. So please go ahead and present your bill.
Members, over the past few years on a bipartisan basis, this legislature has passed a series of innovative new laws to help reduce the cost of prescription drugs. We have been a leader, and this bill is the next step in that leadership. As many of you know, this legislature passed the Alex Smith Insulin Affordability Act, a nation-leading bill designed to prevent Minnesotans from losing their life simply because they cannot afford the insulin they need to survive. This provision was part of our Alex bill that we did not get across the finish line, and it's overdue that we take action. House File 348 would place a copay cap of $25 to help Minnesotans manage three chronic conditions, diabetes, asthma, and allergy conditions, all of which impact thousands of Minnesotans, all of which come with potential grave consequences if not treated properly, and all of which where medications and supplies to manage these conditions have skyrocketed. The high cost of insulin has been widely reported and discussed, so I'm not going to spend as much time in my testimony. But in addition, asthma is a condition that's impacted thousands of Minnesotans. A recent study showed that the average asthma patient pays almost $2,000 per year in prescriptions. This bill would also focus on EpiPens, which have skyrocketed in costs. Importantly, this bill would also cap the cost of medical supplies to manage these conditions at $50 per month. We've spent a lot of time debating the cost of medications in particular, but as you have heard and will hear from testimony, many families are now actually paying more for their medical supplies to manage their conditions than the prescription drugs themselves. And this bill would help cap those costs as well, which are very important to help folks manage those conditions, stay out of the emergency room, and will actually help us save healthcare costs. Minnesota was the leader when we passed the Alex Smith bill, but related to copay caps for conditions like these, we are lagging. More than 20 states, red states, and blue states have passed similar copay caps, and it's time for us to move forward. A couple final points. For years, the insurance lobby has opposed this bill under the guise that it will lead to significant higher premiums and copays. They haven't offered evidence to back up this claim, and now we actually have some better data to assess this. Due to bipartisan legislation authored by Senator Benson and Representative Elkins, any cost-sharing change goes through a rigorous process, an actuarial analysis by the Department of Commerce to assess the impact of changes. And this proposal went through that process, and it found that the average cost per year in terms of impact for copays for members would be 2 cents. Per year in year one, and 3 cents by the 10th year. The average monthly premium cost would be $1 in year one and $1.34 in year 10. And additionally, the report shows downstream savings of a proposal like this, because when Minnesotans are better able to afford their medication, that means they're better able to manage their disease, their condition, stay out of the hospital, stay out of the emergency room, And so, you know, this really is a win-win. The last thing I wanted to mention is that folks may have heard the news yesterday that Eli Lilly was voluntarily moving to cap their costs of insulin at $35 for folks on private insurance all across the country. This is incredibly good news for Minnesotans and Americans. But what I want to mention is the only reason this is happening is because of the public pressure and the leadership of folks like Nicole Smith-Holt and insulin advocates right here in Minnesota, all across the state. And I contend that it's because of the leadership of this legislature as well. The $35 figure is the number that we implemented with our nation-leading Alex Smith Insulin Affordability Act, and it's the number that Eli Lilly announced. Now, there's two other insulin manufacturers. We hope they'll follow suit. But we absolutely cannot and should not trust these insulin manufacturers out of the goodness of their hearts to keep these prices low, when for years they've been selling these products for $350 a vial, gouging Minnesotans, causing Minnesotans to literally lose their life. But what we should do is lock these prices in so Minnesotans have a peace of mind that if you need a life-necessary medication, that you're going to be able to get it at a price you can afford. With that, members, I would encourage your support. And I know that this bill is up in the Senate almost at the same time, so I'm not sure. We might have some testifiers that are kind of running between places, but look forward to the discussion.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Howard. I appreciate your leadership on this. And so we have several testifiers who have signed up. Emily Hassenstab, if you would please come forward. And so the routine here is when you come up to the table, you will get settled, you introduce yourself and just state your whole name and your affiliation if you have one, and then you got 2 minutes to give your testimony. Thank you. Perfect. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Emily Hassenstab. I'm a nurse and diabetes educator at Children's Minnesota. I've also been living with type 1 diabetes for over 18 years. Thank you for having me here to support Children's Minnesota's support of House File 348. Children's Minnesota is the largest pediatric health care provider in the state. I have the privilege of working with families and patients with diabetes in our diabetes clinics, and we serve over 2,400 patients. Our journey with these families often starts with one of the hardest days of their life. It's the day that they learn that their child has type 1 diabetes, a chronic disease with no cure. This is also the day that a child learns that they'll be poked multiple times every day for the rest of their life. Families' lives are turned upside down by this diagnosis. On top of learning how to manage this chronic disease, they also now face the financial burden of purchasing their necessary medications and supplies to keep their child alive. It's not uncommon for families to call me frustrated and scared because their copay at the pharmacy is over $1,000. They don't know how they'll afford that. While there are savings assistance programs for items such as insulin, they unfortunately are very hard to qualify for as there are very strict income limits. There's also a complicated application process that prevents people from actually benefiting from these programs. These also only impact the cost of insulin, and that's only two of the seven basic prescriptions needed to keep people with diabetes alive. Even if someone is eligible for these savings programs, the cost of supplies continues to be unattainably high. If we want to truly support these families, we need this bill. It's been suggested that capping copay costs would lead to an inappropriate overuse and stockpiling of medication, but there are actually many safeguards that would prevent this from happening. First, patients can only pick up the quantity of supply that's prescribed by their doctor, and we prescribe only the amount that they need. Second, if we do prescribe a higher quantity, we have to provide documentation to support the medical necessity for that higher quantity, and that has to be approved by insurance before they can pick it up. With these in place, there should be no concern for that overuse or stockpiling of medication. Today, I ask you to empathize with every family living with chronic disease, such as type 1 diabetes, and try to imagine what that mental toll is of managing that disease is.
And I have to ask you to wrap up, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Knowing that there's a stress of trying to afford these medications, this bill would provide relief to families, and it would also save lives. Thank you, Representative Howard, for your leadership.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Next we have Chad Fanning. Welcome to, he's not available, okay. Carissa Kemp? Okay. He's not here either. and Matt Schaefer. And I should just mention, folks, I noticed that we're going to have a lot of folks from the lobbying community testifying throughout the day on various bills. As lobbyists come up, if you, of course, you're going to tell us who you're here representing, but if you represent any other entities, I know some do and some don't, but any other entities who might possibly have an interest in the bill before us, I would like those to be identified as well, even if you're not actually here representing that entity. So anyway, welcome, Mr. Schaefer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Matt Schaefer. I am the Government Relations Director for Medica, a Minnesota-based health plan doing business in 12 states. Although today I'm testifying in my capacity as a member of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and I'm an in-house staffer for Medica, I do not have any other clients.
Thank you.
I want to start by thanking Representative Howard for his leadership on this issue and kind of hearing the stories about the Alex Smith Insulin Act. And, you know, for us, it hits close to home. Anytime I go past Roseville and see that restaurant where he used to work, I think about him. And I also want to note that obviously our plan, Medica, was one of the first in the country and the first in the region to voluntarily cap our out-of-pocket for insulin at $25. We did that in spite of our concerns that that would make it easier to raise prices, and that would be concern one, what we'd have anytime you're talking about an increase with insulin. I also want to take this moment to give some peace of mind to some of the advocates who may be listening right now, because I know there's a real concern that the products we have that cap that out-of-pocket for insulin, we may just change our mind and remove those from the market. There are federal and state laws in place that state very clearly that if we're offering that product and people are still buying and paying for it, we have to keep offering that product. Now, when the rest of my testimony, I want you to think about it as the yellow light on the stoplight, not green, not red. And the three concerns I have is the one I already stated, is if you raise the price, it does make it easy for the people who make those products to raise the cost. That's probably why a lot of them tend to favor it. The number two is you have to when we're given one of those requirements, we have to balance putting that cap on a copay with all the other pieces of our benefit set. For example, with a silver plan, we have to make sure that 30% of your constituents' expenses in an individual market product are being paid for with another co-insurance or another copay. So we'll have to raise it somewhere else to maintain that right balance. It's not something we want to do, but we have to make sure we're in compliance with the law. And the third piece is what the representative spoke to, $1 per member per month. That's going to come out for a married couple paying $1,000 per month right now approximately. The bill passes, it's going to be $1,002.47. Now, as the representative noted, that's pretty reasonable. When you look at this, though, in concert with some of the other bills that we're going to be hearing this year, they are all going to have an additional cost. And so I just add a word of caution. Madam Chair, I want to thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Yeah, please come forward. Please come down if you want to testify. Yep. Come down to the table and just give us your name and if you're affiliated with anyone, and then 2 minutes for your testimony. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for allowing me this opportunity to speak on behalf of the file. My name is Sarah Ginsburg. I'm from Insulin for All, and I want to thank Rep. Howard for being by our side the whole time and helping us, and you too. I've had type 1 diabetes for 52 years, and my son now, who's 28, has had it for 26 years. I'm fortunate I have good insurance at this time, but have spent many years struggling to pay for what we need. When I hear someone has been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, my whole body cringes. It's a mean disease, it's difficult, and it would be hard to afford the supplies to maintain good health. Most parents' dreams of their children growing up and getting a great job, most parents dream of that. When your child has diabetes, dreams turn into their prayers. You pray that they have good health and enough money to afford the supplies that are needed. This is how I feel now, and this is how I've always felt since my 2-year-old was diagnosed. My life has been greatly impacted by using a CMG, a sensor. Control of my diabetes is better than ever now. I didn't realize what I was missing. My energy is better. I overall feel healthier. I get more done. The expense of supplies is still overwhelming. And even though we have good insurance, I brace myself with copays every January and February, as they are $700, $800, $900 for a copay. This is a 3-month supply of infusion sets and sensors only. Having a sensor should be a part of everyone's diabetes control. I urge you to vote yes to House File 348 so everyone with type 1 diabetes can be the best they can be. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Right.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, is there anyone else who would like to testify? All right, if not, we will close the testimony and we will open it up for member discussion. And I'm not seeing any member discussion. Representative New Brindley.
That I would jump in, Madam Chair. Thank you. I just will make a comment. You know, I think we all understand.
Representative New Brindley, are you using the mic there? I can't see, and it might not be picking you up.
I can use a different one.
Sorry about that.
It won't come out. Is that? Oh, that's way better. Better or worse, depending on your opinion.
Oh, I shouldn't have said anything, I guess.
There's love in the air.
So, boy, now that you can all hear me, I just have a comment quickly. You know, I certainly understand the intent of the bill, and I think we all appreciate the intent of the bill. I'm concerned about the shotgun approach. You know, I think about folks like my sister-in-law, who is a type 1 diabetic, who certainly can afford whatever cost sharing she needs to pay. She and her husband have been very blessed to be very successful, and they can pay those fees. I think about myself, while this specific bill wouldn't apply, when my late husband was ill, you know, just for, I could tell stories, but just for one of his many, many medications, we paid $600 a month for a 1-month supply. That was not a 3-month supply. We paid $600 a month for a 1-month supply. And while I get it, that's a lot of money, I always felt very blessed that my family and I were able to afford it. And I'm always concerned about the shotgun approach, that we are giving this benefit to families who can afford it. And it is going to be on the backs of other families who are struggling. You know, I mean, as has been laid out, when we eliminate these costs, they have to be picked up somewhere. They either have to go into higher premiums, they have to go into added cost sharing elsewhere in the plans, and that's on the backs of people who can't necessarily afford it. And so while I appreciate the intent, I'm always concerned about this approach of this complete elimination. Particularly, we're hearing lots of cost-sharing bills. And particularly on these cost-sharing bills, there are real consequences to that in other places of the market that is going to affect the very people I don't think we want to affect and raise prices for. And so, boy, I know that, you know, the majority does not need to listen to the minority, and they're going to pass these bills regardless. But this shotgun approach to these issues, it's just not a responsible way to govern, and it causes burdens elsewhere on other people. And particularly in this case, it's not that the state is assuming these costs, it's that other payers are going to assume these costs. Other people who are insured are going to assume these costs. And we might say here it's a dollar, there it's a dollar 34, but as the testifier said, we're hearing a ton of these bills. And when you put this together, it's not a dollar. It's not a dollar 34. It's going to turn into tens of dollars and hundreds of dollars and thousands of dollars very, very quickly as we try to do what's right with a shotgun approach instead of being more cautious in how we move forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, we have four other members on the list. So Representative Carroll.
Thank you very much. And I appreciate the comments of Representative New Brindley. May surprise some, but I appreciate them. Those are my concerns as well. I have a daughter who has severe food allergies, and we've had to deal with the spike in the ebb and flow of EpiPen prices. We can afford it. We've done it. She has to carry it. And we have to have multiple EpiPens that she can access. So I'm certainly sensitive to it, and I appreciate Representative Howard's bringing this to us. The concern I have is the actuarial soundness of this approach, and if I can ask the gentleman from Medica to come and address that, I'd appreciate that. And I'm certainly supportive of doing something, but I just want to make sure when we're looking at the whole system that we don't pick and choose and poke holes and do a whack-a-mole approach, and instead have a comprehensive, actuarially sound approach to this.
So did you have a question then, Representative Carroll?
Yes, if he can respond to that and the actuarial soundness of doing this of this legislation.
Okay. I think he kind of did in his testimony, but Mr. Schaefer, do you want to say any more?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Carroll. Yes, to answer your question, per the existing now mandate review law that we have in place, there is an actuarial analysis that takes place where there does end up being a per member per month requirement. And so for a number of bills, including House File 348, there's a report that lays out that the Department of Commerce's projection for this particular bill, this requirement, would be $1 per member per month, which would come out to. And basically what you have to do is you take that number and you divide it by the average silver level plan in a given year, and this year it's $404, and then you take the quotient and you times 1 point that quotient to, sorry, I didn't know you were going to have math class today, 1 point the quotient.
Or not, Mr. Schaefer.
absolutely. That will get you to your answer of what the premium's going to be. But I appreciate the comments and that was exactly the concerns we had. As we're hearing each of these bills, the tally could go up significantly as you and your colleagues are trying to figure out which of these will make it over the hump and which ones won't. And you're going to be hearing a few today that have some pretty big price tags.
Okay, we're going to go to Nadeau, then Bonner, then Schumacher, then we're going to vote on the bill. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you stay up there? So in that report, you know, I know that it was, you know, a dollar per member per month. It reached 134 per member in the 10th year. But later in the report, it talked about that it's going to cost our commercial insurance $320 to $405. So I'm not very smart when it comes to mandate reports. Can you tell me which is it? Is it $1 or is it $4.20?
Mr. Schaefer.
Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau, a lot of that is going to depend on the product and who's buying it for each one of those for in the commercial sector and the individual sector. Now, what I can tell you about that report is I believe a number of carriers submitted our per member per month projections over to the department, and with the hope that it would factor in those costs and the answer, and they'd come up with the answer. And traditionally with other states with mandate review laws, you will see a projection from the agency that's a little lower than what we as carriers think they're going to be. So I would say that other piece with $3 to $4 per member per month could be a little more for a number of employers, particularly those if they have a lot of employees and families who have a family member that's managing diabetes or asthma or has an allergy.
Thank you.
All right.
Madam Chair, just one quick.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you. So I'm probably one of the newest people here, and I'm probably one of the most naive, and thank you, Representative Howard, for bringing this. I think it's important, and I agree with Representative Brindley that the intent here is really good. But the one thing that I have learned in my short time here is that when we eliminate copays, we reduce transparency, and that makes it easier. That makes it easier for prices to increase, maybe not by the people we're mandating, but definitely by manufacturers. And so that worries me. And the other thing that you mentioned that worries me is that you don't want to trust our partners to basically try to drive the cost of care down. And I do trust our partners to help us drive the cost of care down implicitly. And if there's a reason that I shouldn't, maybe that's something that I need to learn. And as Representative New Brindley said, this is, you know, we just heard last week, you know, we're going to expand diagnostic and follow-up care for breast cancer. This one is we're reducing copays. We're stacking these things up, and the impact is going to be profound. It's starting to be profound. And so I love this bill. I mean, theoretically. I mean, you know, I had a father-in-law with diabetes, and I literally, you know, helped him every single day for, you know, 10 years of his life. It's a big deal. He was a veteran. But I just worry about the overall and the overarching impact that we're having. And so thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Chair Justifier. I just have a question, and then maybe I'll follow up, but I'll give you a specific example. So I'm curious, when you talked about the actuarial studies and how that factors in cost savings. So, for example, I think I've shared with you my sister is diabetic, type 1, since age 3. In the course of her travels, she has had heart issues. She's had issues with her blood sugars being inconsistent, some ketosis issues. They put her on a pump. They paid for the pump, but not the cartridges to fill the pump to do that work. And as a result, obviously, the reason they put her on this pump is to better manage her disease and keep her out of trouble, right? At this point, when she doesn't have good management of her disease, she ends up in the hospital on an average of 3 to 4 times a year. My last analysis said that a hospital visit costs on average $10,000 to $12,000 per visit. That costs us probably, so that if you do the math on that, that's nearly 40 some thousand dollars of expense for hospital stays that may have been avoided if she actually had her diabetes under better management, which probably would have cost the healthcare company a couple thousand at best for the supplies that she needed. So can you address how those types of scenarios are actually addressed in terms of cost savings in the actuarial analysis?
Mr. Schaefer.
Madam Chair, Representative Bonner, first I want to thank you for that question. It's a good one to consider. Number one, yes, the projected public health benefit of any type of intervention is going to be factored into the actuarial analysis of what sets a rate. And that's why you see things like first dollar coverage of vaccines and first dollar coverage of preventive care. That has to be balanced with a couple of other things, such as what health care actually costs and where that lands on the balance sheet and how many bills we pay on behalf of our members. And we also have to factor in the other point of whenever we do put a cap on this, where it's $20, $25 to you, the member, that makes it easier for the folks who make these products to come back and quote a significant increase. And ultimately, you won't find out about it until the next rate filing. And there's a pretty good example that with the from 2012 to 2016, we saw the cost of insulin go up about 1,700%. Now, what happened in that time? We had the Affordable Care Act passed, and we had metal levels, and there was more predictability in cost. Therefore, it was easier for someone to say, you know I'm only charging $50 now, but I think I can get $400 out of it. And they were right. Now, fortunately, one has decided, well, maybe we're going to lower the price, and I appreciate that. But to answer your question, yes, the public health benefit element is incorporated into that, but that's also balanced with what we're actually paying for care and what we know we're going to have to pay for care.
All right. Okay.
Very quickly.
Can we really do need to
I will
move
follow
on, Representative Bonner.
Just to follow up, I just want to make sure that we are adequately representing in that actuarial analysis, and I don't know exactly the details of how they put the proof in that pudding. But just in the example alone that I gave you, about $2,000 worth of supplies versus about $48,000 for hospital visits, that means that for every dollar we spent on the supplies up front, we saved $24 on the backside. So just I would love for us to make sure that we are considering that in our analysis.
All right. Thank you. And just to remind members, this committee, the Commerce Committee heard this bill and those actuarial analyses, which, frankly, I think are deeply flawed as a policy in the way they're done, because companies can submit all kinds of stuff that is not available to the public to review to see what the assumptions were and so on. But anyway, this was heard in Commerce. So, Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only question I have is on the fiscal note. Just one of the assumptions there, to kind of your point, with and it's in the MMB area on page 14, the last paragraph in that first section, Just when they're talking about the cost shift that's going on there, they built in a 5% inflation factor for that moving on from 2025. I'm just really wondering where the 5%, what that number came from. Thank you.
And I could ask Mr. Harney if he can address that. This is going to go to state government representatives, so it's but good flag. Thank you. Mr. Harney.
Chair Liebling, Representative Schumacher, the 5% inflation factor factored into CEGIP fiscal notes is, from my understanding, a standard inflation factor they include. I would have to get back to you and speak with the state government fiscal analyst if that's the case or not.
Representative Schumacher?
That's all. Thank you.
All right. And Representative Murphy, you raised your hand after we kind of concluded the list, but go ahead.
Real quick question.
Go ahead. Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question, I met with some pharmacy owners yesterday, small pharmacy owners, and, you know, they talked about some of the problems they're having to even get their costs back. How do you see this program affecting the small retail pharmacies that are in a lot of our smaller communities?
Representative Howard? And Mr. Schaefer, you can step down. Thank you.
Chair Leland, Representative Murphy, it's a good question. I don't have specific information on this bill. I will say that I've worked really closely with pharmacies in general on our work in this space. They were incredibly supportive of the Alex Smith Insulin Affordability Act that included this provision in it. I think that that is an important issue, and I think there's actually some other bills that you all might be even hearing today that sort of speak to some of the issues with our local pharmacists, which are important, very important.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Representative Murphy. So with that, final word, Representative Howard.
Representative Liebling, or Chair Liebling and members, just a few quick comments based on the feedback. One, I would say that I would hope this would be bipartisan because it has been in other states. I mentioned that 20 states have passed this on a bipartisan basis, including states like Texas, Oklahoma, Alabama, West Virginia, to name a few. This is pretty common sense stuff. And to the notion of the slippery kind of slope argument, I just want to just take a second we have tens of thousands of Minnesotans with diabetes managing for themselves or their families, or families that are trying to make sure that their kid has an asthma inhaler so that they can breathe, or an EpiPen so that if they have an allergic reaction, they aren't in the hospital. And we're talking about $1 per year. I'm sorry, are you kidding me? I think every Minnesotan across the state would say that's something that we should do for our kids. And then the other comment is that Representative New brought up the notion of trust. I think that's important. I would say in my short time here, I have absolutely zero trust in the insulin manufacturers, in the pharmacy benefit managers. I have a little bit more trust with our health plans. But let's be honest, those entities, they're beholden to their bottom lines. We are beholden to Minnesotans. And this bill is about sticking up for Minnesotans and making sure that they can afford their prescription drugs, and I would hope members would support it.
All right. Thank you, Representative Howard. With that, I will renew the motion that House File 348, the first engrossment, be re-referred to the State and Local Government Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Howard, and thank you to those who testified on the bill. Next, we have Representative Freiberg, House File 544. And Representative Freiberg, I will move that House File 544 be re-referred to the Commerce Committee. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And there is an author's amendment on the bill, I understand. And there are several. So what's your pleasure here, Representative Freiberg, did
sure.
you want
I believe
to move?
It's the A1 is the author's amendment. It just adds an effective date. That was a request from DHS.
Okay. So.
Yeah, if you could move that,
I would. Out of here. Okay.
It would put the bill in the chair.
So I will move the A1 amendment to add the effective date, put the bill in the order in which the author would like to discuss it. All in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. The A1 is adopted. And then the other amendments are not yours, I understand.
Correct.
Okay, very good. So go ahead then, Representative Freiberg, and introduce the bill.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Liebling, members of the committee. It's good to be back in the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Thank you for letting me present this important legislation to you today. For those of you who were here last session, you might remember this bill. It's referred to as the white bagging choice legislation. And I'm here before you today as the concerns that were raised last year continue today and, in fact, are increasingly realized. House File 544 would prohibit a practice known as white bagging, which is when an insurance company mandates that a patient and their provider seek clinician-administered injectable medications through a designated specialty pharmacy. This legislation would prohibit an insurer from mandating this practice and would instead allow a patient to receive these important medications through their preferred local care provider. To be clear, this legislation does not prohibit the ability for the practice of white bagging to take place, as it sometimes may be medically appropriate and in the best interest of the patient. But this bill would forbid the mandated directive of the practice taking place, thereby limiting the adverse effects seen by patients and clinicians today. The legislation was brought to my attention by a provider coalition that has identified significant concerns with this mandated practice. The patients most acutely impacted by white bagging include those with multiple sclerosis, cerebral palsy, cancer, rheumatoid arthritis, rare eye diseases, and several other conditions. As shared with me, patients impacted by this practice oftentimes find their prescribed medications to be out of network and not covered by a patient's insurance if dispensed by a pharmacy at a local healthcare provider. Instead, white bagging requires patients to use a distant insurer-mandated pharmacy, which fractures the patient-provider care relationship and sometimes creates cost burden for the patient by shifting the type of insurance benefits set. Traditionally, infusion drugs administered in a clinic or hospital are covered under a patient's medical benefit, but when white bagging is mandated, the benefit oftentimes switches to the pharmacy benefit set, which typically has higher cost sharing and lack of premium thresholds. When white bagged drugs are shipped to a physician's office or hospital facility for administration to a specific patient, circumventing long-established supply chain safety processes and procedures established in clinics and hospitals. This multi-step process interrupts the normal course of treatment and blocks providers' ability to deliver the best possible care and service to their patients. In wanting to be respectful of time, I'll refrain from sharing a litany of examples of how patients, their providers, and even patient advocates have been impacted by this concerning practice, and will instead emphasize that white bagging creates risks for patients across Minnesota by sourcing drugs outside the normal supply chain, putting patients at risk of increased cost, and creating delays in medication administration that significantly affects patient health. For many reasons, but most importantly for the patients who need these complex medications at a critical time in their care journey, whether at a clinic, infusion center, or hospital that their providers recommend, I urge you to help me pass this legislation. And I have a couple of testifiers who are here. I think Brenda Reinhart and Molly Skipstead.
All right. So let's thank you, Representative Freiberg. So welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your 2 minutes.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brenda Reinhart. I'm the business office manager at Retina Consultants of Minnesota. We're a group of ophthalmologists. We have here in the state of Minnesota who treat diseases in the back of the eye, the retina, the vitreous, and the macula. We have 11 offices throughout the state of Minnesota, and we draw patients from a five-state region. We treat blinding diseases such as age-related macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, and retinal vein occlusions. 20 years ago, we didn't have great options for these patients. Today, these patients and these diseases respond incredibly well to a classification of drugs called anti-VEGF intravitreal injections. We inject these into the vitreous, which is the gel-like fluid in the back of the eye. Those drugs work on reducing swelling and stopping the extra bleeding that's happening for our patients. Our typical patient needs these injections every 4 to 6 weeks. As we all know, the back of the eye is a pretty small space. We have any type of delay in those injections can cause permanent blindness. Patients may lose vision and they may not get it back. We don't know who's going to be lucky and who's going to be unlucky. That being said, we also have the drugs stored and shipped in a very narrow temperature controlled for the manufacturer, and we've invested a great deal of money in lab-grade refrigerators and temperature monitoring systems. White bagging has affected our patients, both delaying in care and extra cost for the patients. I will only give you 2 examples due to the timing, but I'm happy to answer any questions. We had a patient whose drug arrived from the PBM with a very short expiration date. At the time the patient required his injection, the drug was expired. We could not use it, and the patient had to pay 2 copays. The PBM would not work with us in replacing that drug. We also have drugs that are not arriving in our office at the time of the patient's appointments, so they have to return a week or two later. We request those drugs 4 weeks in advance, and it does get delayed frequently. That is probably our biggest problem. I thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you for your testimony. Molly Skifstad. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Molly Skifstad, and I'm a pharmacist here in Minnesota. I have been a pharmacist for 15 years, and most of my time has been spent in infusion centers, caring for patients with chronic conditions such as Crohn's disease, rheumatoid arthritis, and, of course, many of them with cancer as well. I care for patients on the Iron Range to Duluth, and with my current role across the Essentia Health System footprint here in Minnesota. Unfortunately, during these years of my career, I've witnessed white bagging growing and impacting patient care in a negative manner. So as Brenda highlighted, it delays care oftentimes. Sometimes medications don't arrive on time. And this can be impactful for our cancer patients. Certainly, it's very well documented that time is outcomes in cancer often. And for those with the chronic conditions such as Crohn's or rheumatoid arthritis, when their care is delayed, they'll often see emergence of their symptoms again. This impacts their quality of life. And unfortunately, both of these are not hypothetical situations, but situations I have personally seen. As a pharmacist, we're always concerned with safety. Safety with these medications in the shipment process has been also witnessed by pharmacists across our state. They've arrived frozen, broken, delivered to the wrong address, I should say. These medications are typically in liquid form that we're going to then compound to infuse, and are large molecules that are fragile in as far as molecules go. So this transportation and the pedigree of their shipment is very important to us. Oftentimes this leads to waste, obviously with the shipment issues, but then also many medications require adjustment due to labs, due to weights, due to disease state. And so oftentimes if these medications are already shipped to us, we cannot dispense that to another patient, we cannot return it. And so if that changes, it has to be redispensed, and oftentimes patients have to also pay additional co-pays right. for those as well.
I have to ask you to wrap up, please.
Yep, perfect. And so that also increased the cost to patients. So given the impacts to patient care, that's why you're seeing this moving across our country. It's being led by physicians and pharmacists because we are putting our patients first and advocating for them. I ask you to help us with this bill, House File 544, and I thank you for your time and happy to answer questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Bentley Graves. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Bentley Graves with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. As was mentioned before, this is an issue that has been kind of bubbling up for the last couple of years. As it started to be discussed, it's something that we took a fairly close look at for two reasons. One of which is, as you all know, I think we work on healthcare issues because of the cost considerations for our employer members, but also. Our members offer those benefits to their employees to keep them healthy, safe, and productive at work. And so we also want to make sure that policy proposals that we bring forward have an eye on the concerns of the patient as well. And this is an issue that kind of uniquely highlights some safety concerns, but as on the other side, cost considerations. So we went kind of looking for solutions to this particular problem. And in so doing, found some work done on this issue in Massachusetts by the Massachusetts Health Policy Commission. They took a fairly deep dive into this issue and came up with a couple of findings in what we think is a particularly helpful recommendation. First and foremost, on the cost side, they did find that maybe not surprisingly, drugs through specialty pharmacy chains are significantly lower in cost than when provided through the provider buy and bill. They also noted that we heard some mention of the out-of-pocket that there isn't typically a significant difference in the out-of-pocket between a benefit that pays for these drugs through a specialty pharmacy or a buy and bill, and that really kind of depends upon the benefits, the design of the plan, and the price of the drugs. But what they did do is make a recommendation that we think helps to kind of address some of the safety concerns that have been brought forward, but also some of the cost considerations, which I think you hear a lot more about in the next testifiers, and that is a site-neutral payment policy that allows providers the option to use the buy and bill method to ensure that they are able to give the drugs to the patients there in their setting, but with reimbursement set at the third-party level, especially pharmacy third-party level. So that's something that we've talked to Representative Freiberg about. I've talked to folks on both sides of this, and we'll continue to offer that up as a potential solution. But I appreciate the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. Okay, Margaret Reynolds. Welcome to the committee. Please go ahead. 2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Margaret Reynolds. I'm here today on behalf of the Cigna Group. I'm going to touch on the cost containment issues that you've heard and go a little more in depth. I did provide some testimony in your packets, so please feel free to refer to that as well. But the clinician-administered drugs are a tool that's utilized by health plans and clients that leverages our specialty pharmacies to safely distribute certain drugs to help improve affordability. Although the language in this bill would seem to increase access to these drugs, it does not. In fact, it does not increase access in any meaningful way, and it will not allow for a plan or a PBM to manage the overall cost, which is critical in this specialty drug space. Failing to control costs will negatively impact the cost of patients' care and therefore actually reduce access. It should be noted that specialty medications are the largest and fastest growing segment of the U.S. pharmacy market. And while only 4% of Americans use specialty drugs, they account for 65% of total drug spend and 19% of total health care spend. As the cost of these drugs rise, it will continue to make it more difficult for patients to afford care. This bill would limit health plans' ability to leverage innovative solutions like white bagging to make prescription drugs more affordable while protecting patient safety and improving care. Provider-administered infusions and injections that are included in Cigna's white bagging policies cost an average of nearly $509,000 per patient per year in hospital outpatient facilities, according to our internal data. Our white bagging policies cut those costs by nearly $253,000 per patient per year while allowing patients to continue care with their same provider and maintaining our high standards for affordable quality care. There have been some patient safety issues noted. The only reference in the bill to patient safety is on lines 2.31 to 3.2, and it just references federal code, which we abide by. Our specialty pharmacies are all accredited. We would love to work with the author as this bill continues to move on beefing up some of those patient safety protocols. We certainly think there could be guardrails in place, both from a provider and an insurer perspective, to make sure our patients are at the center of this. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Alex Summer. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning. Morning still, I think. All right. Alex Summer, representing Prime Therapeutics, pharmacy benefit manager. Based in Minnesota, owned by 19 not-for-profit Blue Cross and Blue Shield plans, including Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota. I do want to back up and just talk about what the white bagging patient experience is. White bagging is something that is used where it's clinically appropriate to ensure the patients have access to high-quality care when it's clinically appropriate at the best possible price. So here it is, we're talking about a patient that has a scheduled appointment. They go to that appointment, their provider of choice. They get the let's say an infusion treatment. They get that treatment, and they go home. Where that drug is procured from is outside their purview. That drug is going to the whole point of where that drug is procured from and sent from is about what the cost of that is so that patient gets the treatment they need at the best possible price. There have been some points here about the safety and efficacy of specialty pharmacies and the drugs that are being sent. Those specialty pharmacies that we use for white bagging are highly accredited pharmacies that meet certain high quality standards like safety and timeliness, both of which drugs are, we know that via the URAC, which is the high probably the most prominent accrediting organization, that these drugs are delivered on time over 99% of the time and safely over 99% of the time. So whatever stories we're hearing about the issues of the drugs being delivered safely or timely, those stories don't match the data that we have. The only question here really is about who is getting paid for the drug and how much. And when that who is the hospital, that how much is significantly more, not $5 or $10, but thousands of dollars more per claim. Moreover, I do want to point out that in this bill, we've talked about it as a white bagging bill, and this bill goes significantly further than that and takes away other alternative sites of care to provide high-quality, cost-effective alternative sites of care to ensure that people are getting the treatment they need at the best possible price. That includes things like home infusion where clinically appropriate to ensure, again, that the same treatment's being provided. It's just a question of how much that treatment costs. And again, here, when you get rid of this option for white bagging or get rid of the cost savings that come with white bagging, that how much is significantly more. Just to provide the committee with an example, one drug, Mvasi, when provided via home, that drug costs $414. When it's done in the hospital outpatient setting, over $7,000. We're talking about very real money.
I have to ask you to wrap up.
Thank you very much. And for these reasons, we oppose the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Peter Fjellstad. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Peter Fjellstad, and I'm the Director of State Regulatory and Legal Affairs for the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, alternatively known as PCMA. We're the National Trade Association for Pharmacy Benefit Managers, also known as PBMs. PCMA's PBM member companies administer drug benefits for more than 275 million Americans, including millions of Minnesotans, who have health insurance through employer-sponsored plans, commercial health plans, union plans, Medicare Part D plans, medical assistance, CGIP, and others. We appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony at this hearing. Today, I would like to express our concerns regarding House File 544, a bill that would prohibit PBMs and health carriers from the specialty drug delivery practice commonly known as white bagging. PBMs use a variety of benefit management tools to help these plans provide high-quality, cost-effective prescription drug coverage to plan beneficiaries, i.e., employees and their families. The language in this bill would establish specific requirements related to a health care provider's administration of prescription drugs, as well as a prohibition on how a PBM or a health carrier classify coverage for such a drug. The reason for the specialty pharmacy practice of white bagging is to both maximize patient safety as well as cost efficiency. This is particularly important at a time when Minnesotans are experiencing a 40-year high in inflation. PCMA's PBM member companies, together with their client health plans, use specialty pharmacies to deliver high-quality, accessible medicine and pharmacy services while promoting product affordability. PBM flexibility to continue contracting with these select pharmacies is key to ensuring access and promoting drug affordability for Minnesotans. In limiting plan-sponsored choices to allow for the practice known as white bagging, this bill would substantially increase costs for Minnesotans. Research shows that that restricting white bagging has the potential to cost Minnesotans $175 million in excess drug spending. On the other hand, I'd just like to speak briefly to the safety concerns.
Well, I'm sorry, but your time is up.
Okay. So. Thank you very much for your time. Right. Happy to answer any questions from the committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Andreessen. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, Trade Association for Minnesota's nonprofit insurers. First, I just want to thank Representative Freiberg for meeting with us a few weeks ago on this bill, and we're committed to continue talking with him as this issue goes forward. First of all, if the drugs are arriving mislabeled or damaged, then someone in the distribution chain is violating federal laws and regulations. They need to be held accountable for that. However, it's not clear if the examples cited have been occurring in state-regulated markets. This is because no council health plan requires providers to white bag their specialty drugs, and our plans cover 92% of the fully insured market. And this is the only commercial market that's going to be impacted by this bill. So this bill is not going to change practices in any commercial market here in Minnesota. However, if providers are worried about future white bagging requirements, they already possess the power to avoid this. They simply need to stop their practices of marking up specialty drugs that they purchase and pass on to their consumers. And we've had previous testifiers talk about these markups. Here's an example of how this is impacting Minnesota patients. And this example is from a medical bill that I have seen. a Minnesotan who lives with multiple sclerosis is in the fully insured market, goes to a clinic to get their medication. And this clinic acquires their drugs through buy and bill. They get the drug on their own. If that patient had bought that drug for the six-month dose, the manufacturer would have charged them $32,000 for that drug. The clinic that this patient went to charged her $97,000, $65,000 over the list price of this drug. That's a 300% markup. And that bill did not say anything about why the provider needed to collect $65,000 over the list price for that drug. People living with chronic conditions are already paying a lot for their care, and these excessive markups are making it harder. Many times this session we've heard that insurers need to lower their premiums and cost sharing, but this takes away one of those tools. We can avoid this problem entirely if providers would just stop marking up specialty drugs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. Nick Zerwas? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Nick Zerwas with the Jacobson Law Group, representing today the American Health Insurance Plans. We've had an opportunity to provide, thank you for the opportunity to provide comment to the Health and Human Services Committee today. We have concerns with the legislation as introduced. Specialty drugs are high and extremely fast-growing cause of cost in today's health system. Specialty drugs share of net spending across institutional retail settings has grown from 27% in 2010 to over 50% in 2020. Physician markups on specialty and clinician-administered drugs tend to be excessive. The markups are significant. The cost per AHIP study that was done from 2018 to 2020, and I'm referencing a letter that's in your packet that has a link to the study, it showed that cost per single treatment for drugs administered in hospital were on average $7,000 more expensive than if it were done via white bagging. Drugs administered in a physician's office is on average $1,400 over cost of white bagging. Hospitals on average charge double the price for the same needle, the same administration. It's just what seat you're sitting in. Double the price than a specialty pharmacy. Prices were 22% higher in physicians' offices. And we've worked with the Senate author, and I pledge that AHIP will work with Chair Freiberg on this language as well. We are committed to finding safety language that meets advocates' concerns. And our request is that in that process, we come up with a solution in which the hospitals agree to administer the drug at the same price that we and every other pharmacy can acquire and administer it for. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. And Mr. Zerwas, you're here today representing America's Health Insurance Plans.
Yes, ma'am.
Are you still a lobbyist for CVS?
I am.
A PBM?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And that's the kind of information that I think the committee needs to know when you're up testifying for an entity, and another entity that you represent obviously has a deep interest in this as well. Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Okay, is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing anyone. So we have a couple of amendments in the packet, and does anyone wanting to offer those amendments?
Madam Chair, the A2 is mine.
Okay, Representative Nadeau, do you want to offer your amendment?
Yes, I'll move the A2 amendment. And
is
thank
that the
you, Madam Chair.
A2-1, Representative Nadeau, just to be clear.
A2-1.
Okay, to your amendment.
And thank you, Representative Freiberg, for bringing this. Thank you for engaging so much with me. As I've looked at this and learned more about this topic than almost anything this session so far, so I do appreciate that. So this amendment is really simple, but I think it has a profound effect and an impact. It simply exempts the nonprofit plans from the bill. In Minnesota, you know, we're lucky, and I've mentioned this before, you know, we're the envy of the nation as far as having options that for patients, center-based care, the partnerships that our plans and providers and MCOs have with their patients and providers, unlike almost any place in the nation. And what I'm trying to do with this bill, we've heard today that there can be cost savings with white bagging. There, and in some cases, it's at the cost of certain things that we want to make sure that we remedy. And what this bill does is it simply retains that tool, and as far as I understand, and I could be wrong, someone can correct me, that there's none of our Minnesota-based MCOs, the nonprofit organizations, are actually engaging in white bagging today. So what this bill does is it exempts those people, those companies from this bill, leaving them with tools and options as we move forward. If it comes up or becomes an issue later, we can maybe address it. And that being said, Madam Chair, Representative Freiberg has agreed to continue to work with me on this issue, and maybe he's got something to add or not, but I will be withdrawing this amendment unless there's any discussion.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Doe. Representative Freiberg, did you want to say anything about the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Nadeau. I appreciate your withdrawal of the amendment. I am happy to continue to work with you. I've had several good discussions with you already about this. We'll get to your next amendment. This amendment, I would be inclined to be a little less favorable towards. I mean, just to put it out there. As you said, there are no Minnesota-based health plans that currently engage in white bagging. I mean, sort of the whole purpose of the legislation is to protect patients from some of the harms we've heard about white bagging. So, I don't see there as being any need for it because it's not done currently. But it is a protection I think should be available to Minnesotans in the future, regardless of which plan they choose. But as I said, I'm happy to continue working with you.
All right. Thank you. So the amendment is withdrawn. And then we have the A3. Is that yours as well, Representative Nadeau?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move the A3.
Okay.
This one. Can I proceed?
Yes, please go.
Thank you. This one is a little bit more, it's more interesting for sure. we heard one testifier talk about, I think it was Massachusetts, where they talked about site-neutral reimbursement policies, and that's exactly what this amendment does. It basically creates a site-neutral component so that reimbursement rates are literally the same wherever they're delivered. It creates more options for patients. It creates more opportunities for payers and providers to deliver that in a cost-effective way. And I think that this is probably one of the most important things that we can probably try to do to work into this bill if it proceeds forward. And once again, I want to thank Representative Freiberg for providing me access to his, to his group and the advocates that are moving forward. I've listened to people on both sides. I don't think that there's as much objection to this one, but once again, I'm willing to withdraw this amendment because Representative Freiberg has intended to work with me as we move this bill forward, and that I really appreciate. So thank you so much.
All right, and Representative Freiberg, did you want to say anything?
Thank you again, Representative Nadeau. Appreciate your willingness to make sure the language is solid and that every concern has been addressed. This one does seem like it comes closer to something I could support, but I do want to make sure there's no unintended effects of it or anything. So, this bill has another committee stop in Commerce. This seems like the type of issue that could be addressed there, and I'm happy to continue working with you to do so.
All right, thank you. So the amendment is withdrawn. Okay, so is there any further discussion to the bill? Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Discussion to the bill. I'll be honest, I'm a little bothered that it sounds like Representative Nadeau and Representative Freiberg have already been having conversations about this site-neutral payment, effectively, what that is. They've been talking to the advocates, and yet we're still not ready to move on it. And that tells me that we're not going to be ready to move on it. So I sure hope I'm wrong on that, because it's really hard to look at this bill and not think that there's something to that. You know, I mean, we keep talking about the safety issues, but as I read the bill, I think there are 60 lines, and only 5 of them are related to safety. And those 5 lines just reiterate the federal law that's already being followed. So I'm wondering, Representative Freiberg, if you can tell us a little bit more about how this is going to affect safety. And a tangential question to that would be, you know, one of the things we heard about were problems in shipping, getting things late, or what did we hear? Distant pharmacies, frequent delays. But would all of the sites that would be administering these drugs, would they all, like, how do they get the drugs to begin with? I mean, there's shipping involved regardless, isn't there? And so how is that problem solved by this bill?
Okay, so before you answer that, Representative Freiberg, just put a pin in that question, if you would, for 1 second. I want to address the first part of the comment. First of all, I think having members work with the author of the bill before the bill gets to committee is entirely appropriate and what we want when we have the time. So correct. I, to the degree that the comment made it sound like that was not appropriate, I want to absolutely clarify that that is indeed the process. And also that passing a bill out of this committee to the Commerce Committee, where it probably, if it goes forward, it may be part of the omnibus bill there, is absolutely also part of the process. If we require a bill to be in perfect form before going through each committee stop, there is no purpose to having committees other than just punching a ticket. So I just want to be clear that what we're doing here, hopefully, is understanding, getting more information, and then giving members the ability, so should they so choose, to work with Representative Freiberg, who, according to many things that have been said today, is very open to working with members. This is the process. So,
Madam Chair, please, that is a gross misrepresentation of what I said.
Misrepresentation.
Excuse me,
Representative New Brindley, I do have the floor and you do not. And I did not characterize what you said. I'm just making a statement about the way the process works. So, Representative Freiberg, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In my mind, and thank you for the question, Representative New Brindley, in my mind, this is a patient choice bill targeting anti-competitive PBM business practices, which we've heard about. I do think the safety issues are important, and this has the ability to improve that as well. I think, though, just given that you asked some pretty specific questions, I think it would be appropriate to have one of the testifiers come and answer how this would address those specific practices.
Okay, and welcome. And you are, I think, Molly Skifstad, am I right? Okay, welcome back, and please go ahead if you want to address
it. Thank you. So in relation to the shipping and handling and the statutes, the federal statutes that are in the legislation, so where those apply is between suppliers and a pharmacy. And I have no doubts that these specialty pharmacies are meeting those regulations. Currently, they cannot meet their requirements without it. So we have no doubts that they're meeting that. But those regulations do not apply when medications are shipped to a patient, which in this case, white bagging, I, as the pharmacist at the infusion center, become an agent of the patient. I am no longer a pharmacy, and so those regulations do not apply between the specialty pharmacy and myself. And so the pedigree and the requirements there are not the same as between a supplier and a pharmacy when it goes pharmacy to an agent of the patient. So that's what the legislation calls out, is to now apply those in that space as well.
All right. Thank you. All right. Follow up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. But I assume that you also are currently following those regulations.
Correct.
Okay.
So when it comes from my
supplier, and we need to go through the chair, so Ms. Skifstad. Go ahead.
So, correct. When I order the medication that's on my shelf that I would use to administer to a patient that supply, yes, those regulations are in place. But when I'm receiving it from that specialty pharmacy through white bagging, there is no regulations on that space currently.
Representative New Brindley, and
thank,
then we have
thank
another
you, Madam
question.
Chair. But I would assume that you are still following those regulations, even though it sounds like you are not directly required to follow them, but I assume that you are. But my next question then would be for Representative Freiberg, since you are not viewing this as a bill on safety. My question then is, well, and again, related to the A3 amendment, can facilities then, how will you ensure that these facilities can deliver these same specialty drugs for the same reimbursement that is currently paid to specialty pharmacies through white bagging? I mean, we heard several examples in testimony of how much more expensive the drugs have been when they're going directly to these facilities. I mean, people do this because it saves money.
Right. Let him answer. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. I was just waiting to be called on. So the bill does not prohibit white bagging. So I just draw your attention to the language starting at line 2.4 of the bill. The language simply requires PBMs to permit patients to access clinician-administered drugs from authorized providers. It does not prohibit patients from using drugs administered by pharmacies affiliated with the PBMs. So it's still an option that's out there if it is the most cost-effective. And I don't
for who? All right. Okay, so Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just had I just have a couple of questions, and I don't know if the bill addresses these or not, and so I just wanted to throw them out there for the record. We heard that hospital markups are significant. Is there anything in the bill that would prohibit a hospital, for example, from marking up the drug cost? Is there anything to control those costs in this bill?
No.
Representative Freiberg?
I don't believe so, but Ms. Gifstad can add into if I'm misstating anything. This just addresses the process of white bagging and requires other options to be available.
Correct. Ms. Gifstad.
So the payment on the medications are negotiated between the providers and the payers outside of this. The scope of this was to really address the safety concerns, and as Representative Freiberg said, you know, it does still allow it, but it just gives a voice to the patients and to the providers rather than being forced to do this with no ability to ensure that it is a safe practice for our patients.
Thank you, Madam
Chair.
Right. So this doesn't.
Representative Nadeau.
And so, oh, thank you. And so this is, so there still could be significant differences in costs, and I don't know what percentage of these infusion drugs are delivered in that setting versus what we're doing here. So there still is some work that we could possibly do to lower the costs in that area. And my final question has to do, I think specifically, we've heard that this has a lot to do with patient choice. And so can a patient choose to have their drugs sent to a clinic via white bagging? How does it work now, and does this bill change that? How much choice does a patient currently have, and how will this change that?
Ms. Skifstad?
So currently, when these conversations are happening, I've unfortunately looked in the whites of patients' eyes and had these conversations, there is no choice of the patients. When we go to get the prior authorization to administer the medications, we're told it has to be white bagged. And so then it's the conversation with the patient of that it's being required to be white bagged. And so, and sometimes us as the pharmacy or the providers are able to call that external specialty pharmacy to get the fills. But sometimes we have to explain to the patients that they're the ones who actually have to call and generate the fill to be sent to us. So it's a hard landscape to navigate, because often there's confusion of why we can't just have the medication for them there, and why it's having to come from an external pharmacy. So currently there is not a choice.
Okay, thank you, Representative Nadeau. Okay, I think we really need to move on here, if that's okay. And so Representative Freiberg, closing comment?
Well, as I said, this is a patient choice bill. You have some letters of support for the bill in your packet from the Healthcare Distribution Alliance, oncology organizations, and the coalition supporting the bill. Out of respect for your time, I'll leave it at that and encourage members to support the bill.
Okay, so I'm going to renew my motion that House Bill 544, as amended, be re-referred to the Commerce Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the amendment or the bill is on its way. Thank you very much, and to represent Freiburg and testifiers. So Representative Bierman is going to take the gavel.
All right, the next bill on the agenda is House File 1752 from our own chair, Liebling. And House File 1752 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. That is my motion. And I would like to move the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the shape in which I would like to have it discussed today.
The amendment is moved, and the bill is in the order you wish it
okay,
to be in.
So we need to vote on that motion, Mr. Chair. So.
Oh, okay. So motion to approve the amendment has moved.
Okay, all in favor?
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. So moved. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Proceed with your bill. Yes,
thank
please.
You. And so, members, this is a bill that this idea has been before the legislature before in the last cycle. I had a bill like this. What this does is carve out the pharmacy program from the managed care organizations and run it all under fee-for-service. We've heard a number of bills this session already about the managed care organizations. Representative Freiburg has a bill, Representative Fisher has a bill to get them out of the business altogether. But this just carves out the pharmacy. So this is an alternate proposal. And so this was actually, in prior years, it was part of the governor's proposal. This year it is not, but I'm bringing it back, and because I think it is extremely important legislation. I'm not going to talk much more. I have with me Luke Slindy, who is going to present the bill to you and explain to you the importance of it, and it is very compelling, and I hope you will, it is to me, and I hope you will all find it so as well.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. And Mr. Slindy, if you could introduce yourself for the committee and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Madam Chair. I am Luke Slindy, a second-generation Minnesota pharmacist, and I'm here today to discuss rural community pharmacies, the medical assistance drug program that over 1.4 million Minnesotans use for their medication benefit, and the state's use of for-profit pharmacy benefit managers in that program. I grew up in Harmony, a small town south of Rochester. Many of you may be familiar with Harmony's representative, Greg Davids. For reference, I know him well and attended school with his children. For many years, my family owned and operated Slindy Pharmacy. Like many Minnesota small towns, it was the only pharmacy in town. However, in 2007, when I was still in pharmacy school at the U, my family decided to sell the business to another small local chain. The primary reason? Abusive and anti-competitive business practices from very powerful for-profit pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs, and unsustainably low payment rates. Fast forward to 2022. Increasingly worse conditions caused the new owners of the pharmacy in Harmony to close the business altogether, leaving Harmony without a pharmacy for the first time in over 100 years. Unfortunately, Harmony's circumstance is not unique. Here is a list of Minnesota cities that had a pharmacy in town in 2006 but currently have no pharmacies. You may recognize a town on this list in or near your own district. The loss of a rural pharmacy creates significant barriers to healthcare access and the loss of economic vitality due to the absence of an anchor small town business. Now let's talk about Medicaid in Minnesota.
As of January 2023, approximately 85% or 1.2 million Medicaid beneficiaries receive their pharmacy benefit via a for-profit PBM, subcontracted from a managed care organization. For these 1.2 million patients, a pharmacy is paid by and is forced to interact with one of the for-profit PBMs on this list. Fortunately, there is good news. Minnesota has an already existing Medicaid fee-for-service program that currently covers the remaining 15% of beneficiaries, pays pharmacies directly from the state, and treats pharmacies much more reasonably. This chart highlights four key ways the fee-for-service program is better for Minnesota pharmacies compared to for-profit PBMs. One main benefit is transparency. The network contract terms and the payment rates to pharmacies under the fee-for-service program are public information, in contrast to for-profit PBMs whose network contract rates and opaque maximum allowable cost MAC rates are considered trade secrets and proprietary. Unfortunately, I have learned that in pharmacy, proprietary means we are going to keep this information secret in order to take advantage of everyone who is not us. To reinforce this point, prior to submitting a claim to a for-profit PBM, a pharmacy has no idea what the payment rate ultimately will be. Another benefit of the fee-for-service program is the source of payment rates. To determine dispensing payment fees, the fee-for-service program collects cost accounting data from pharmacies themselves to help determine reasonable rates, allowing pharmacies to participate in the payment rate setting process. This cost data separately quantifies the acquisition cost of the drugs or the price a pharmacy pays to stock each drug on the shelves, as well as the actual costs of dispensing, including staff wages, rent for the building, and other operating costs. Alternatively, the processes that for-profit PBMs use to set payment rates is, again, proprietary and a big mystery. The final benefit of the fee-for-service program I will discuss is a lack of patient steering. Patients under the fee-for-service program may fill their prescriptions at any network pharmacy, while for-profit PBMs often attempt to force a patient to use a mail-order pharmacy or other pharmacy owned by the PBM, creating a lack of patient choice. And the entire last bill was an example of this. The coerced use of PBM-owned mail-order pharmacies is particularly detrimental to rural pharmacies. In my opinion, the evidence is clear. The existing fee-for-service program is much better for patients, pharmacies, and the state. And many other states agree with me. Here is a list of states that have already removed for-profit PBMs from their Medicaid pharmacy benefit while still retaining managed care organizations for medical coverage and other non-pharmacy benefits. As you can see from this mix of states, this proposal is not a traditional partisan issue. I thank Chair Liebling for once again authoring this important legislation, and I humbly request you support HF 1752 to remove unnecessary and harmful PBM payers from medical assistance, transfer pharmacy coverage for all beneficiaries to the existing fee-for-service program, provide better access to needed patient medications, and help preserve the state's rural community pharmacies. As a final note to 340B covered entities and the amendment being offered today to address some of the covered entity revenue concerns, we encourage stakeholders to work with Representative Liebling to come to an agreement on how to offset potential 340B revenue losses. Other states that have already completed this process have been able to redress this issue and fully implement a fee-for-service model for their state Medicaid pharmacy benefit. Thank you, committee members, for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Schlindy, for your testimony. We have another testifier, Mr. John Heschen.
And Mr. Chair, before we go to the other testifiers, could I finish just presenting the
bill? Absolutely, Representative Liebling.
So I hope that members understand that besides so many other reasons why, as legislators, running the pharmacy program through the managed care organizations is bad for us and probably far more costly for the state than it needs to be, we're also killing our small pharmacies with this program. And I think that Mr. Slindy's testimony to that effect is very compelling. But I also do want to tell folks that the DE1 also has language that attempts to deal with the 340B program, because as you all who were here before may remember, the pushback we got on the bill is because of the operation of the 340B program, which is a federal program which has drug companies giving deep discounts to managed care, or let's see if I can explain this, the giving deep discounts on their prices This is really, it's funny because hardly anybody actually does explain it very well.
Yeah.
But anyway, let me put it this way. There is a hidden subsidy that is flowing through the managed care programs to a lot of organizations that we all know and value, hospitals, clinics, et cetera. And so when you start to say we want to get the MCOs out of this business, some other organizations say, hey, wait a minute, you can't take our money away. Well, this is a hidden subsidy. We as legislators are funding this without even knowing how much it is or where it is going. So one of the things that this bill attempts to do, and I will continue to work on, is to try to get our arms around where that money is going, how much it is, and attempt to hold harmless these organizations that we are not intending to hurt with this bill. But we will be in a much better position if we are able to accomplish this. The other thing that I've done in the amendment is to require, because there's an effective date that's out pretty far on this, just for DHS to be able to accomplish this would be January of 26. The bill also would require that the MCOs in the meantime reimburse the pharmacist for the cost of filling a prescription at the fee-for-service rate. So a pharmacist the other day showed me his receipts, I guess you'd call it, where we, the state, reimburse $10.77, I believe it is, right now, for the cost, and this is cost-based, based on a study, what it costs a pharmacist to fill a prescription. The MCOs are paying pennies for a prescription, so like 10 cents or 15 cents, when their cost of filling the prescription is at least the $10.77, that's the average cost. So you can understand how hard it is to stay in business when you're getting that kind of reimbursement and when some of the time you're actually paying more to acquire the drug than you are being reimbursed for the drug. So with that, we'll take the other testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. And next up is Mr. John Heschen. If you would state your name for the committee and then proceed, please.
Here today. My name is John Heschen. I am a pharmacist of 34 years and the current owner of St. Paul Corner Drug, located in the McAllister Groveland neighborhood of St. Paul, where I have practiced since 1989. Like most other independent pharmacies, we offer a high-touch, patient-centric level of care with the goal of meeting our patients' needs wherever they are along their health journey. I am speaking today in support of House File 1752, on behalf of all the other independent pharmacies and pharmacists located throughout Minnesota. I know that every one of them wishes they could be here to voice their concerns regarding the current state of community pharmacy here and across the United States. I hope to impress upon you the gravity of the matter at hand and what can be done now to avert an already developing health crisis in our state. Over the past 6 months, my pharmacy filled approximately 4,000 prescriptions under the prepaid medical assistance program, also referred to as PMAP. That is roughly 10% of our volume. Of those 4,000 prescriptions, 650 of them had a gross revenue of less than $4. 300 of them came in at less than $2, with the lowest reimbursement being 3 cents for a prescription we dispensed three times over that six-month period. Of the 4,000 prescriptions filled, 1,600 or 40% of the claims had a gross revenue below the current statutory dispensing fee of $10.77. This fee amount is determined by surveying pharmacies across Minnesota to establish what it actually costs to dispense a prescription. For those 1,600 prescriptions, we essentially gave the product away free and did not even recover our cost of doing so. 400 of these 4,000 prescriptions were brand drugs, ranging in cost from $200 to $2,400. The total drug inventory for these 400 drugs was about $200,000. Nearly 100% of these brand drug claims were reimbursed at or below actual acquisition cost of the product, with no account for any overhead costs such as labor, rent, insurance, licensure, supplies, etc. To my fellow business owners in the room, when was the last time you purchased $200,000 worth of goods and sold it all below cost? This is absolutely 100% unacceptable, unsustainable, and abusive. If something doesn't change now, more pharmacies will close, including mine. Where will these patients go for service? The answer to that question is not down the street to the chain pharmacy. During September and October of 2022, the closest pharmacy to us had significant decline in service level due to staffing and other issues. We were taking on anywhere from 10 to 15 new patient transfers, not scripts, patient transfers, all of their stuff, 10 or 15 a day. By November 1st, we could no longer safely continue to accept additional patients and made the decision to stop taking new prescription patients effective immediately. That policy is still in effect today because we are still beyond capacity, with staff coming in early and staying late just to keep up with our workload. In recent weeks, the last pharmacy in North Minneapolis closed its doors, along with the area's last grocery store. CVS and Walmart have both announced that they are cutting their service hours from 9 p.m. to 7 p.m. at nearly two-thirds of their pharmacy locations nationwide. Communities like North Minneapolis and rural areas are home to some of the most vulnerable individuals that rely on the Medicaid program for their health needs. Losing access to pharmacy and food supply creates a whole new kind of social desert, and along with it, set of challenges for these folks. Many may not have time during the normal business hours or reliable transportation to be able to travel to the nearest pharmacy, which is now almost 4 miles away. In short, a health crisis. If nothing changes, there may never be another pharmacy in North Minneapolis. However, if this bill becomes law, there could be a pharmacy in North Minneapolis by the end of 2023. This proposed legislation is that pivotal to the matter at hand. Over the past two decades, we've been told there's nothing the legislature can do regarding reimbursement for pharmacy claims due to Medicare and commercial plan exemptions. That is not the case with Medicaid. The state is already adequately paying for this service. But by the time the money gets to the actual provider, me, there is nothing left. The middleman is taking all the resources and completely decimating the pharmacy provider network of Minnesota. This must stop, and it can. I implore you to make certain that this bill makes its way through the legislative process this session before it is too late, or I fear many areas of Minnesota, both rural and metropolitan, will be without pharmacy services for a very long time. I thank you for your time, and I can answer any questions anyone has.
Thank you, Mr. Heshen, for the testimony. Anyone else in the public that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll go to member questions and discussion, please. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and really more of a process question here. Again, I understand there wouldn't be a fiscal note yet on this, that's going to be still in the process, but just comparing this to the 2019 bill and the fiscal note there, of course, some of the dollars are going to change, but has the policy changed significantly that you're expecting it? Are the assumptions going to be similar within that, or will those be different as well, particularly the part about DHS needing to pay back the MCOs for the withholdings that they currently have on that? Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Schumacher. Well, there is a lot different here. The 340B program is significantly different, and I have no idea what that would cost, frankly. That's kind of part of the problem, right? We have no idea. And also, I put in here the requirement to pay for the MCOs to pay that 1077 between now and when this bill would go into effect. Otherwise, we're going to lose pharmacies. I when I heard these stories, I brought this bill last time, but I really didn't realize the impact that it has. So it is different, and I eagerly await the fiscal note because I really think this is a crisis situation for pharmacies across the state.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Follow-up? No follow-up. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't here in 2019, so I don't really know, but thank you, Representative Liebling, for bringing this up. It won't be a surprise to you that I'm always supportive of more options rather than less, and I'm not sure that the PMAP example that was given is probably the best. You know, this is our lowest income people. You know, there's a lot of services that people on PMAP get. I mean, everything from reduced classes in the community to car seats to, I mean, it's not just reimbursement for prescriptions. So I don't know if that's the greatest example. Do we need to do something? Absolutely. I totally agree. But I'm not sure that this is the right thing. The question that I'm, if we're going to move and DHS is going to become the PBM, for example, my understanding is that DHS is prohibited. Are they licensed to be a PBM? My understanding is that statute right now prohibits the Department of Human Services to be a PBM. That's my first question. And the second question, will they have a preferred drug list? And if they do, who will, I mean, right now DHS oversees those preferred drug lists for MCOs. Who will be that overarching entity at that point to oversee DHS? I guess those are two questions.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau. So two things. One is we're not here to re-debate the Fisher bill today. This is not about getting rid of the MCOs altogether. It's about carving out the pharmacy program. That's the bill we have it for us today. So that's what we're here to discuss. And the other thing is that they already run a program. We've heard about it in this committee. We've heard about the pharmacy pharmacy committee we talked about, and we had Chad Hope. He's here. I mean, I don't want to, again, we have a lot of other business to do today. I don't want to, you know, relitigate what we already did here in the committee, but they are already doing it. They have the fee-for-service program running. It works very well, as you heard here in the testimony. And they don't need to be a PBM. I'm not really sure where you get the idea that they would become a PBM. They're already running the Medicaid pharmacy fee-for-service on the fee-for-service side. So I think there would be other opportunities to talk to DHS about that if you would like, but we're not reinventing the wheel here. We're just putting the rest of the population that is covered under MA into the existing program.
Thank you. Representative Becker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the pharmacies on the screen was one in my community, and another one was in the district. And my daughter and I have talked about this. She's a pharmacist and represented Keele's area. So I really appreciate what you're trying to do. I really do. My concern, though, is will the state have a greater success than PBMs with negotiating the prices? You know, we can see the problem, but as we have talked about, this is new territory. My concern is that the best option? You know, is an agency better than the PBMs at negotiating the prices and so forth? So that would be my question. What would be your take there, Madam Chair?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Backer. So federal law governs this, and they get discounts under federal law. And, I mean, I could get Mr. Hope, I think he's still in the room, or here he comes. I mean, I don't really want to get into all of it right now, but yes, I mean, they have mechanisms for this, and they're doing it for 20% of our population now. So I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Mr. Hope, if you want to state your name for the record.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hope. Please state your name and proceed.
My name is Chad Hope with the Department of Human Services. I oversee the pharmacy program. Representative Liebling is correct. We have been performing these functions since 1991 for the fee-for-service program. As far as the prices that are paid and negotiated, we are actually in a almost a better spot than the PBMs because we have access to the federal Medicaid drug rebate data that the PBMs do not have access to. That's a mandatory program out of the federal government that's a condition of accepting federal funds for the program. So without that knowledge, the PBMs don't actually know what the lowest cost products are. They only know what the lowest retail cost products are.
Thank you. Mr. Becker.
Yeah, thank you. And I appreciate that, and that's why the bill's before us here to get into the details. We have had a track record that agencies have not performed well in certain arenas. I would want this to be successful because the course that we're on right now with the pharmacies, I already lost 2 years ago the pharmacies, not I, but our community did in Browns Valley and then in Ashby nearby. So I'm just concerned it looks good on paper. I just think we need to dive into it more, but I do appreciate what you're doing, Chair, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hope, if you would say, I appreciate that you were here. I was hoping you would be. My question is for you, particularly with these changes to 340B, what PBM does DHS use now, and how? What do you do with the rebates now? Do they go directly to the consumer or the pharmacy, or how? What do you do with those rebates now? How are those used?
Mr. Hope.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is not a PBM for the fee-for-service program. DHS directly administers the program ourselves. And the rebates, we are directly invoicing the manufacturers, collecting the funds. They get deposited in the state accounts and shared with the federal government based on the split for the programs. And then those funds are returned to the general fund as far as financing the Medicaid program. So none of that stays with DHS. It goes back into the funding of the program itself.
Thank you. Representative Brindley, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So right now, then, those funds are used to offset the cost of the program overall.
Mr. Hope.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thank you for that response, and I do have some concern about this because of that, because I think that, generally speaking, that's how the rebates are used across the board. And so there are a lot of unknowns with, as Chair Liebling indicated herself, that we don't know these things, but what we do know is that right now those rebates are being used to offset total costs, and so I have some concern about what we're doing with that without that complete set of knowledge. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Liebling, for bringing this forward. I think this is a very critical part that we need, that we're getting a handle on. And I think what we're looking at is that while we're hearing that supposedly the current program is saving costs, what we're finding out is the expenses, we're cutting back on services that are available for the people of our state of Minnesota. And that's what motivated me with the bill I had out there. And we're seeing it's not just in clinics, we're seeing it all over the place in pharmacies. And what it does is the holes that we create don't get filled out there, and it means that we have less and less available for services for our people throughout the state of Minnesota, primarily hitting parts that are rural and parts that are communities of color. And I think it's very important for us to take a look at. I think that there will be savings in here that will actually defray the cost of the programs and make sure that we continue to keep these providers throughout the state of Minnesota alive. And I think that's the important part that we have to focus on, is what are the services for the state. So thank you, Representative Liebling.
Any comment, Representative Liebling?
No, I guess we had another testifier that needs to be able to yes. testify, and so I guess I would just ask if we could.
We can go to the other public testifier, and then we will have Representative Keel and Representative Elkins, and then we will lay it over.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the committee, please, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Danny Eckert, and I serve as the Director of State Government Relations for the Minnesota Hospital Association. House File 1752 proposes to transfer Minnesota's managed care outpatient Medicaid pharmacy benefit to a fee-for-service model. While it is not explicitly stated in the bill and as mentioned by the bill author, an unintended consequence caused by the complete transfer of the benefit to fee-for-service triggers a federal rule that will eliminate an estimated $125 million annually in savings for eligible safety net hospitals that participate in the 340B program. This estimate does not include impacts to other safety net providers participating in the program. For your reference, we've submitted an issue letter and issue brief for more details on this. To be brief, so we appreciate the chair's new approach in the DE amendment and the recognition of the unintended consequences to 340B and Minnesota's safety net providers. At this time, we are still assessing the new language and its changes to how the bill, as amended, impacts the federal 340B program in Minnesota. So we look forward to working with the chair, with this committee and the legislature as this bill continues through session. And I stand for any questions, and I'm happy to follow up with anyone to talk about 340B.
Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate that. Representative Keel.
I'll pass.
Representative Keel passes. We have Representative Elkins.
I had a quick question for Mr. Hope, if he's still here.
Yes, he is on his way down.
I can state the question while he's running down here.
I believe he is still on the record for, so you may just proceed, Mr. Hope.
Yeah, I was curious, do you know, Mr. Hope, how the 340B prices compare to the Medicare prices that you have through the federal government?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm assuming you're asking the difference between 340B price and the Medicaid rebate net costs?
Yes.
Mr. Hope.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the prices are similar. 340B can be lower than the net cost after the Medicaid rebate. We unfortunately don't have access to the direct 340B prices. HRSA doesn't release those. We are able to calculate what's called the 340B ceiling price estimate using two confidential numbers that we can't disclose to anyone because of federal law. But in a nutshell, it tends to be a slightly lower on the 340B side than our net cost, but whether it's meaningfully so, it's hard to say.
Okay, thank you.
Any follow-up? No follow-up? You're complete? Very good. All right. We can have final words.
All right. Just thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to just lay the bill over.
Thank you. The bill, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus.
Thank you.
Okay, and we will have one more bill to come. I'll switch chairs.
All right, we're going to take up House File 1665, and so Representative Bierman is moving that House File 1665 be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance and Policy Committee. And members, this is a bill that we heard informationally. I don't think there was any controversy about it, but we did not have the bill at that time, and so we're just bringing it back so it can actually be moved, and I believe there is some urgency with the department, with the Board of Pharmacy, and Representative Bierman, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, this is House File 1665, which we did hear. This is about the pharmaceuticals listed in the bill that the federal DEA has already placed on a federal schedule. And these items are presently listed on the schedule in Minnesota, but it had a 12-month expiration date. So this is a public safety and law enforcement issue, essentially, because if we delay and don't get those added officially in Minnesota, if someone is found with those products in their possession, they cannot be charged. So simply putting them, adding them to the schedule is what we're planning to do. And we had some discussion over this last time, but if there are any further questions, we do have the Board of Pharmacy in the room, and we can bring them down.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Bierman. So are there any, is there, well, I should, I guess, we did take testimony, I believe, but is there anyone in the room who wants to testify on the bill? Oh, please come down. Welcome to the committee. If you would state your name and give us your testimony, and very briefly, please.
Indeed. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Curtis Hanna. I'm with the organization Minnesota Normal as their registered lobbyist. As you've heard at the last hearing, the substances the board is lobbying the legislature to classify in state statutes via this agency bill today were already temporarily classified in Schedule 1. They're given this legislatively delegated authority in Chapter 152.02, Subdivision 12. The heading of that subdivision is Coordination of Controlled Substances Regulation with Federal Law and State Statute. And today I'm just simply wanting to point out to the committee that the only sort of coordination that is allowed to the Board of Pharmacy in this subdivision, and really in all statutes, is for state regulation to conform to federal law. And what I am simply asking today is for the committee to consider the idea that we also should give the Board of Pharmacy authority to be able to try to engage with the federal government to have them conform with state changes that occur. There's a couple different incidences or ways in which this could occur. So in 1974, anonymous drug checking was legalized in the state of Minnesota, but within months, the DEA actually came out with a federal regulation saying that testing for the purity of a controlled substance was not legal. So the Board of Pharmacy at that point could have engaged with the DEA to try to allow this sort of thing. Also in 1976, the Minnesota legislature decriminalized marijuana possession. The state of Minnesota could have engaged with the DEA asking for an exemption from federal law for possession of small amounts. In 2014, the medical cannabis law was passed where we legalized two manufacturers to grow and sell marijuana. I think it would have been beneficial to request an exemption. I'll finish this last point. I think it would have been beneficial to request an exemption from registration from the DEA for those two medical cannabis companies. Thank you for your time.
All right.
Appreciate
thank
your
you.
Consideration.
All right. So with that, is there any discussion to the bill? All right. Seeing none. So Representative Bierman is going to renew his motion that House File 1665 be re-referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Elkins, House File 1711. Representative Elkins is going to move that House File 1711 be re-referred to the Commerce Committee. Representative Elkins, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So at the present time, most of the drug rebates are that they're negotiated by the PBMs and their negotiations with the manufacturers are passed on to the plans and largely used to buy down the premiums on the drug plans, in the health plans as a whole. What this bill would do is require that those rebates instead be passed on to the patients who are taking the drugs that generate those rebates, basically buy down the price of those drugs at the point of sale. So all of the PBMs have the capability in place to be able to do these point of sale rebates, as they're referred to. OptumRx, which is based locally, has been doing this and promoting it since 2020. The bill is based on language from a law that was passed in May and Maine in 2019. Got the language through the National Association or National Academy of State Health Health Policy. Basically, what it would do, and it will have an impact, there was a mandate review report for this, which didn't provide a whole lot of useful information, to be honest. But you would see, and it's not measured, but you would see a slight increase in plan premiums if that revenue is diverted away from subsidizing premiums to buying down the price of the drugs for the people who are taking them. But the benefit would be is, A, I think it's more fair that the people who are taking the drugs benefit from the rebates. Most importantly, it would improve drug adherence by reducing the price of the drugs. People would be more likely to buy them and take them, which would have health benefits. It's being done. So, no amendments today. I am continuing my conversations with the stakeholders. Established in the negotiations or discussions related to the fiscal notes for DHS and CGIP, that this would never actually affect them because their copays are so low. They never have coinsurance. It would never trip, and so there will be no fiscal notes from DHS or CGIP on either. I'm probably just going to end up taking them out of the bill when I get to Commerce. And the last thing I really kind of have to work on, I'm still working with the PBMs to make sure that the language in the bill would enable them to implement these kinds of programs using the software capabilities that they already have.
All right. Thank you, Representative Elkins. So is there anyone who, oh, let's see, we do have some testifiers on the bill. So let's go to Mr. Graves. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Bentley Graves with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I appreciate the conversations that we've had with Representative Elkins about this, and I think everything he said is correct. I would just flag, you know, our concerns again from the cost side of things. There's no question that passage of this bill would bring some benefit to those who use these drugs, but would likely raise premiums for the rest of the pool. And that's something that is outlined in the mandate review report. It's something that, with a similar proposal at the federal level, the CBO, the actuary for CMS found, and it's something, as we heard just right now, you know, DHS and Managing Public Programs does the same thing, uses these rebates to buy down the cost of the program for everybody. So moving in that direction, you know, would lead to increased premiums for the pool at a time when, according to SHADEC, Minnesotans pay more in kind of all-in health care costs than basically anybody else in the country. And so something that we've talked with Representative Elkins about, but we nevertheless have concerns about. But I appreciate the opportunity to add that context and that input here today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. Peter Fjellstad.
Good morning. Good afternoon again, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Peter Fjellstad. I'm the Director of State and Regulatory Legal Affairs for PCMA again. I'd like to start by saying that I know that my colleagues at PCMA and other stakeholders have been working very closely with Representative Elkins on this language for a long period of time, and I'm just going to speak very briefly on the language as is and our opposition to it as is. We appreciate the opportunity to testify on HF 1711 that would require PBMs and health carriers to use rebates received from manufacturers specifically at the point of sale. PBMs use a variety of benefit management tools to help their health plan clients provide this high-quality, high-cost-effective prescription drug coverage to plan beneficiaries. One of the tools is to use rebates to lower the cost of drugs for plan enrollees. It can be done at point of sale through cost sharing such as co-pays, co-insurance, deductibles, or by lowering premiums for the entirety of a particular plan's enrollment, similar to the previous discussion on what DHS does for the state's MA population. PBMs were brought into the healthcare system by health plan sponsors to lower prescription drug costs by negotiating directly with manufacturers and pharmacies. And numbers don't lie. Studies show that increase in drug prices is not correlated or caused by rebates negotiated on behalf of patients by PBMs. They only reduce costs. Through a request for proposal process, plan sponsors can actually negotiate how manufacturer rebates will be handled and what levels of disclosure and reporting they desire from their PBM. About half PBM client contracts currently in the commercial sector are negotiated to include full pass-through of manufacturer rebates to the plan sponsors. Other clients have elected that PBMs should retain the portion of these rebates to lower administrative fees. In summation, we respectfully oppose this bill in its current form, and we look forward to continuing to work with the bill's chief author. I'd like to thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? Okay. Not seeing any. Is there any discussion? Okay. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Elkins, thank you. This is, if there's a way to actually direct those rebates to end users, I am all about that, and I think where you're going is great. The thing that I'm worried about, and maybe this is what you're working on, and you're trying to find that balance in, is that currently the PBMs are using that money to lower premiums, and what this is going to do is this, what we're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that we're going to take over kind of that, and we're going to say, you know what, it's more important that we reduce those costs to the users of these drugs than it is to try to keep premiums at a lower level.
Is that fair? That's fair.
Okay.
Representative, we got to go through the chair. Yeah.
Sorry, Madam.
Representative Nadeau.
Okay. And so that being said, you used the example in Maine, and I'm not familiar with it. Did it actually lower prescription drug costs, copays, to the users, and was there an incremental increase in the premiums in Maine? Do you know?
Representative Elkins.
Madam Chair, I haven't seen an analysis of it, but what I know is that what it mostly impacts is people are taking very expensive drugs that are on coinsurance. Usually, if it's a less expensive drug that is subject to a copay instead, this wouldn't even kick in. That was the experience when we looked at at CGIP or DHS. The copays are already so low that this would never kick in. So the main beneficiaries are going to be people who are taking what would be tier 4, tier 5 drugs in a commercial formulary, things that may cost anywhere from $25,000 to $100,000 a year, where a 25% coinsurance might be $1,000 a month. I mean, my wife is taking a drug that has a list price of $32,000 a year, and we are paying $4,500 out of pocket for that drug. So it's mostly the primary beneficiaries are going to be people who are taking expensive specialty drugs and are paying coinsurance on the list price of the drug instead of the price that the plan and the PBM have actually negotiated.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. So final word, Representative Elkins?
No, I think we had a good discussion. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So Representative Elkins is going to renew his motion. That House file, what are we here?
1711.
On two different pages here, sorry.
1711.
1711. House file 1711 be re-referred to the Commerce Committee. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way, and we are adjourned.